It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 499 of the Colombia Calling podcast. This is the final episode for 2023. We will be back in January, around January the 9th, if I'm not mistaken, with episode 500. We are searching out the ideal person for this, well, numerically significant episode ahead of us. 500 episodes. I think you'll agree that it's pretty special to have got this far. A weekly niche podcast about a country in South America, Colombia, the country that we all love and obviously want the best for. So please think of anyone you would like to hear from, and perhaps if you have any contacts, let us know, because we are all ears. And indeed, this could lead to other interviews and guests on the show. So we will be working on this for the next, well, the next month or so. Anyway, so thank you again to everyone, absolutely everyone who supported us on Patreon this year, the previous year, and so on. We are immensely grateful to you. Please share the word. That's www.patreon.com/Colombia Calling. Thank you so much to our supporters there. Remember, those of you on Patreon, you do have the free access to Colombia at a Crossroads, a social and historical biography that I wrote about Colombia, a book of facts. And indeed, I will, of course, be putting up a reduced price of Better Than Cocaine, Learning to Grow Coffee and Live in Colombia, the first book this year published by my small editorial, Fuller Vigil, and it's by Barry Max Wills. It's out in bookstores now, in all independent bookstores in Bogota. If you just check out our Fuller Vigil, V-I-G-I-L, editorial on Instagram, you'll see the list of bookstores that you can find this in for around 60,000 pesos, or just over $10, $12 more or less for this book. An excellent debut novel from Barry Max Wills, located in Colombia's coffee zone. There will be more books coming next year from the editorial, so watch this space. Of course, it's basically time for me to say this week's episode will be with the director of Colombia Risk Analysis, Sergio Guzman, and one of his political analysts there as well, called Daniel Poveda. And they will be talking a little bit about the report on Chinese investment in Colombia, but we'll also be focusing on, well, taking a look back at this year, 2023, in Colombian politics for the presidency of Gustavo Petro, and a slight look forward, 2024. What will it herald for the country? It's a very interesting episode with which to finish 2023, and I know you'll enjoy it because you always enjoy listening to Sergio Guzman on this show. He continually draws in the numbers, and his show, when we were talking about the reasons behind the paro nacional, or the national strike, all those years ago in 2019, still remains the most popular episode historically for the Colombia Calling podcast. So there you go. Pretty amazing. That's above people like Wade Davis. It's above other luminaries in this world. But no, Sergio is the most popular for you guys. So it's a huge compliment that he chooses to come back on the Colombia Calling podcast. And all that's left to say is, if for those who celebrate, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and to the rest of everyone, happy holidays, rest up, and of course, get recharged for 2024 and all the challenges, success, and light and happiness that it will bring to all of us. So thank you again from myself and from Emily Hart, and she'll be on with the news just now, but thank you from both of us for being such loyal listeners this year.
The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Columbia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your headlines for the week of Monday, December the 18th, 2023. Both of the major armed groups currently in negotiations with the government have agreed to halt kidnappings for ransom. Kidnapping remains a key issue in Colombia. Just this week, the Ombudsman's Office published a list of 91 people who remain in captivity in the country. At least 287 people were kidnapped in Colombia between January and October of this year, the highest number since 2016, according to NGO Pares. The second round of peace talks between the government and FARC dissident group, the EMC, the Estado Mayor Central, has come to a close this week, with the group agreeing to halt kidnappings and a mutual agreement to set up a ceasefire monitoring and verification mechanism. The government additionally have pledged to denounce alliances between state security forces and illegal armed groups. The next round of talks will take place in Bogotá in January with a focus on illicit crops and the Amazon, where the EMC is the dominant illegal actor. And guerrilla group the ELN, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, has also agreed to give up kidnapping this week. It's an issue which has been a significant obstacle in negotiations with the government, particularly following the high-profile kidnapping of footballer Luis Diaz's father. This round of talks, the fifth round, also ended with agreements to extend the ceasefire and address paramilitarism in Colombia. The next round of negotiations with the ELN will be held in Cuba, managed by the new head of the government delegation, former senator and former M19 guerrilla, Vera Grave, who has replaced Oti Patiño. The Constitutional Court declared a state of unconstitutionality due to the persistent, serious, and generalized violation of the fundamental rights of social leaders and human rights defenders. The court has called for their urgent protection. So far this year, 182 social leaders have been murdered, according to think tank Indepaz. The investigation continues into President Gustavo Petro's son, Nicolas Petro, for money laundering and illicit enrichment. Meanwhile, his ex-wife, Day Vasquez, has agreed to collaborate with the Attorney General's office in exchange for immunity. Vasquez would be protected from prosecution for money laundering, for which she is also charged, for 2 years, having pledged to be a prosecution witness against her ex-husband. She has publicly linked Nicolas Petro to figures in drug trafficking and accused him of embezzling money supposedly destined for Petro's presidential campaign. She does also say, however, that the president himself was not aware. Nonetheless, hours after this deal was revealed by magazine Semana, the Accusations Commission of the House of Representatives opened a preliminary investigation into the president in order to determine whether illicit money entered his 2022 presidential campaign. And more polls this week, with the president closing the year with a 66% disapproval rating, the highest it has been, according to Inbamer. Vice President Francia Márquez shows comparable ratings with 56% disapproval. 56% of those polled favour dialogue with armed groups, and 41% would prefer military defeat. It is the lowest support for the policy of negotiation in nearly 8 years. Those were your top stories for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is episode 499 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Our very special guests this week are none other than Director of Colombia Risk Analysis, Sergio Guzman, and the Analysis Coordinator for Colombia Risk Analysis, Daniel Poveda. And it's a great pleasure to have them both on this the final episode of 2023. And we're going to, well, we're going to look at a new report they've got out, which is incredibly timely, as they should be, and very interesting. It's entitled Understanding China's Tech Footprint in Colombia, Challenges and Opportunities. But we're also going to look back at the year in politics in Colombia and maybe a couple of predictions for the year ahead, 2024. But first, Daniel, Sergio, welcome on the Colombia Calling Podcast.
Richard, thank you so much for having me on again. It's a pleasure to be back. And I celebrate with you 499 episodes, almost 500. I'm very excited about the potential surprise you have for us in episode 500.
It's huge, and I don't know what to do yet for episode 500. So anybody listening, if you've got contacts with someone amazing, you know, amazing, please, please send them in, because I really need, obviously, we need a landmark interviewee for a guest, best is said. And Daniel, this is your first time on the podcast, and you are going to be taking the reins to begin with, I think, about this this report on China, Colombia. And just as one quick question, this is a follow-on from the report earlier in the year about sort of China's influence in Colombia and so on, that we, Sergio, myself, and who was it? It was
Tara Torres,
that's it, who's gone to Oxford, I think, since then.
Correct.
Amazing. Look at that academic footprint you have, Sergio. Tara Torres, and then that's right. So tell us, Daniel, tell us about this report.
All right. Thank you, Richard. It is my first time on your podcast. I do hope it isn't the last time, though. So I'll tell you a little bit about it. Our last report on this subject was called Local Perceptions of Chinese Investment in Colombia. You guys can all download it and read it. It's on our website. And what we found out there is that there's still much to be known about the relationship between Colombia and China. And what we saw is that there is a very special relationship with Chinese tech investment in the country. So what we sought out to do was kind of do a little bit more research on the subject and see what's happening on those, what one could say are initially commercial ties, but we saw a very interesting political factor there. And as you know, Richard, and as we saw in the news recently, well, Colombia and China now consider themselves strategic partners. So I mean, this report comes at a really great time where we can see that we're becoming closer trade partners and also strengthening our political ties. So the report comes at the best time where we can see how Chinese technology, cutting edge Chinese technology, is making an impact in different sectors here in Colombia, such as mobility, transportation, renewable energy, infrastructure, healthcare, security. They have this digital and technological footprint here in the country. And this report is out here to understand how this works and how this investment is present in Colombia.
Mm-hmm. So we talk about this, and we talk about this, as you say, it's a relationship and it's a strategic partnership. But how does this differ from where Colombia was before in a relationship with China?
So it's great that you mention it, Richard, because we do believe that kind of like having elevated these bilateral relations don't really mark much of a change in the relationship between the two countries. So what we think is that this announcement of a strategic partnership was actually kind of a step short or a step shy of actually announcing that Colombia was going to sign on to the China's Belt and Road Initiative. Mm-hmm. So what we think is that the current government, it was kind of timid and hesitant to actually sign on to the initiative and not actually become closer partners. So that hesitation is also very interesting, because there were many rumors the weeks before President Gustavo Petro's visit to China, where we thought that he was going to sign on to the Belt and Road Initiative, but that didn't happen. So we think that's very interesting. We do think that, I mean, this sudden change in the relationship does mean that we're becoming closer partners. However, it does also signal that Colombia isn't prepared and isn't ready to take that next step with China. So that's very interesting.
In terms of our neighbors in the region, who else is signed up? I mean, who is signed up for the Belt and Road Initiative? Because Colombia obviously is a strategic partner in, well, South America for the U.S. And, you know, Gustavo Petro, while he has many, many faults, would understand that that partnership needs to be protected, that with the U.S., but at the same time, kind of play both off against one another for the benefit of the country itself. So who in the region have signed up for the Belt and Road?
Well, many countries in the region. Actually, Colombia, it would be one of the last to sign on if we ever did so. Venezuela, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, very recently, if I'm not wrong, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay. So what we do see is that we're kind of lagging in this aspect. And I'm glad that you mentioned the whole United States factor, because we do believe that that is very important whenever the country is going to take the decision to actually adhere to the Belt and Road Initiative. We do think that even though Colombia is sending these signals of having a closer and growing relationship with China, we do believe that since the United States continues to be Colombia's closest ally in the region, well, we do think that this kind of does have an impact and this hesitancy that we see and being able to sign on. So that's very interesting. We do think that there's some kind of loyalty to the United States and that Colombia hasn't actually figured out that we don't really have to choose anymore. And we see that our neighbors in the region are not choosing between the United States and China and do have important relationships or at least trade relationships with both countries. However, Colombia being its closest ally in the region, or at least I do believe it to be so still, well, we do see that that might play as a factor not being having a closer friendship with China at the time.
I mean, it's a curious one. It's a curious one as we go into 2024 and what could happen. You know, let's say that Donald Trump gets the Republican nomination and therefore, you know, an incredibly high probability. Again, we're predicting. Let's say he wins the next election. And of course, a lot of his ranting and raving up on stage is about China. This, you would think, could benefit Colombia by not being, you know, the Belt and Road. But then, of course, the Trump presidency was kind of known for having no foreign policy, real foreign policy objective. So I don't know. I mean, Colombia, you'd think, well, I don't know. This plan sounds strategic. This plan sounds like President Petro had it organized, but it doesn't feel long term. It doesn't feel like nothing in politics feels particularly long term because you've only got the 4 years. But it doesn't feel long term. What do you think on this basis then?
All right, Richard. Well, on the first point of Donald Trump possibly being president, being elected president next year, we do believe that even though Colombia will continue to be a close ally of the United States, whether it be a Democrat or a Republican in the White House from 2025, we do believe that a Trump administration could make the relationship a bit rocky and difficult to navigate. Right now, we have noticed that the Petro administration is interested in having a special relationship and continuing to have a special relationship with the United States. Most of his domestic policies and ambitions and goals need the support of the United States, such as total peace and whatnot. And I'm glad that you mentioned that this kind of approachment to China doesn't seem long term, because definitely what we saw in the report is that these decisions that we're making in technology or with Chinese tech are indeed long term.
Oh, good.
So it's very interesting. Because even though we don't seem to have this kind of strategic relationship or approachment to China, we are definitely taking decisions that are going to be long term with this Chinese tech investment. So as we can see in the 5G tender that's about to happen on the 20th of December, we're going to see who are those great winners of kind of like the spectrum, the 5G spectrum. because I know we're late to the party to get 5G here. And what we can see is that these big operators here, telecommunications operators here in Colombia, most of them use Chinese equipment and technology for their networks. So what we're seeing is that Colombia doesn't really have isn't really thinking this through of this commitment to China on the long term.
Now, you said that there is an increase of, let's say, Chinese influence or interest in politics. I need you to tell us all about this.
All right. So in the report, what we can see is obviously China, and from kind of like this joint statement that they issued with Gustavo Petro, they say that even though we didn't sign on to the Belt and Road Initiative, they do say that we're welcome to do so in the future. So the doors are open to actually adhere to the Belt and Road Initiative in the future. We're not sure if that's going to happen during the current administration, though. And here in Colombia, what we do see is they do have an interest in closening ties with us. And we do see that the technology sector is one of those sectors where they have, where there's a great Chinese presence. And what we do find out is that we don't really see these investments through a political lens here. From China's point of view, well, we know that they're here for the long term, and they know that these investments are long term. And I mean, having a great participation in the 5G network will be very difficult to replace or change in the future. And we see that this happening in other sectors of the market. We can see this happening in mobility, where most of, or if I'm not wrong, all of the electric fleet of buses are Chinese. So what we do see is that they do have this kind of interest of being a close, at least commercial partner. And this tech investment seems to be very revealing of how they want to kind of close in on Colombia. And we see this repeated in different sectors. The report obviously has much more details, but it's interesting how this happens in the security sector, even though we have a very close relationship to the United States in that regard, how that's happening in the health sector. Recently, we saw the announcement of having a vaccine production factory that's going to be opened here in Bogota. So we do see that how with all of these technological investments, or at least technological in nature, they are closing in Colombia and having, well, they do see us in the long term, at least. Mm. So what we can see is that China's kind of setting up the scene for in the future, if Colombia has a rocky relationship with its closest allies, well, we can always count on China as a plan B. That's what I see, at least.
Oh, okay. When we, maybe this is the moment for Sergio to jump in, but when we look at, let's say, international diplomacy, international relations, what's going on right now? And I see that, you know, Colombia is obviously ideally positioned and very carefully positioned, having reopened a relationship, a diplomatic political relationship with neighboring Venezuela. And Colombia has been the conduit for the U.S. to negotiate with Venezuela, hence therefore, you know, the lifting of sanctions and so on. Looking at what's going on now, Venezuela and, of course, the aggressions, spoken aggressions at this moment towards the Essequibo nation, they're part of Guyana next door. Surely there has to be an influence as well from let's say Chinese government diplomacy. They're very involved in Venezuela. There has to be a connection. It is all a big chess game here, Sergio. I'm sorry to drop you in that one.
No, you know, this is my bread and butter. I think one of the problems with Colombia's foreign policy is that it doesn't necessarily reflect the long-term interests of the Colombian state, but mirrors the domestic political interests of the administration in office. And that's exactly what Gustavo Petro has shown time and time again. He went to China the week before the local elections to try to get an announcement to underground Bogota's first metro line.
Yeah,
that was the objective of the trip. And he walked away of the first meeting with the Chinese construction company saying that he himself, like the state, would finance 100% the undergrounding of the metro. To me, that suggests obviously the people in China told him no. And also they didn't tell him no because they don't like Petro or they don't like his objectives. They told him no in part also because if China agrees to finance the undergrounding of Bogota's first metro line without consequences, without penalties, how many other countries are going to be in a line out the door trying to renegotiate contractual terms with Chinese firms that are doing their job? And this, of course, shows that Petro is only thinking about himself in this dynamic geopolitical relation. He doesn't understand the global chessboard, as you put it very well. And to that extent, I think when we translate that to other conflicts like Essequibo, Petro is looking at it to how is this going to affect total peace? Mm-hmm. How is this going to affect, not how is this going to affect Colombia's standing geopolitically? Is this coherent with what I've said about, for instance, Palestine, where he's, you know, up in arms about a big aggressor state against a smaller state, which is mirror the situation in Guyana? He's obviously calling for peace conferences and talks and dialogues, but, you know, look at what's happening in Ukraine also. He is also not taking a side in that conflict, but he does choose to side with the Palestinians on their conflict. And, you know, I don't want to weigh in on the merits of each case, but it definitely shows that Petro doesn't manage foreign policy in a coherent way that takes into account the fundamental interests of the Colombian state, but instead look at his whims, look at his caprichos, look at his sort of way of understanding politics and his, you know, internal turmoil with his previous experiences, and projects them instead of saying what is the Colombian government's underlying best interest. And this is not a defense of the previous administration or the administration before that. This is more like a reprimand against the Colombian foreign ministry. And the relationship between the foreign ministry and the executive branch and the presidency, because I think right now the foreign ministry is completely subdued to the whims of the executive, of the president, of the chief executive office of the country, and not really looking at, you know, long-term interests in Colombia. And I think a large part has to do with the fact that the people that we put as ambassadors or as consuls abroad are not the most qualified people that go through civil service training. Some of them certainly are. And I'm sure some of them who listen to this are going to point out the exceptions. But I would remind you, they are exceptions. And so we need to professionalize our diplomatic service, and we need to make sure our foreign office is independent, but also is one that looks at the state's best interest. Problem with that is every president that comes into office promises a version of that I just mentioned, and then quickly after they take power, they recognize it's a very important tool for internal political tradesmanship to achieve congressional and legislative objectives. So with that, I'll just jump off my soapbox, but say, you know, this is part of the problem.
So, I mean, basically, I mean, I think there's a direct arrow pointing at the newly installed Roy Barreras in London.
And look, you know, what they say is Roy Barreras could come and take the Ministry of Defense, right? Yeah. Which would be a complete slap in the face to His Majesty the King, to whom Roy Barreras just last week, with a lot of pomp and flair, presented his diplomatic credentials to. So how does it look that Colombia has these diplomats who present credentials, and all of a sudden they get summoned back to the country to serve in office? I mean, you know, who's going to last more as ambassador, Roy Barreras or Aleris? right?
It's a tough one. But I just think, well, if we go back and we go back and we go back, that so much of all of this geopolitical posturing and, of course, the games taking place behind closed doors and you know, dark alleyways, I would think, of the diplomatic circles. I want to bring Guyana up again because, of course, the oil found, and it's Exxon, you know, and Exxon is obviously of a different section of the world, and China very heavily invested into Venezuela, and Venezuela in some dire straits at the moment. Colombia could be, you know, is so well positioned to be an international broker at this moment, and I just don't see the current government doing that. Or am I not seeing something that everyone else sees? I don't know. Maybe, well, Daniel,
my view, and maybe Daniel can complement this, is Maduro, this is all about internal politics, yes, for Maduro as well. This is about throwing off the candidacy of Maria Corina Machado, mm-hmm, who won the opposition primary, not making a commitment to honest and open and fair elections in 2024, mm, and drumming up some foreign mess, just like in Argentina, in Malvinas, in 86, trying to create this disarray abroad to consolidate power domestically. Having said that, you know, there's a lot of questions about what happened in 1899. Yeah. And Colombians should know, because that's how we lost Panama. But I also don't see Petro or any other presidency trying to reclaim Panama, for instance.
Yeah.
That right now would seem ridiculous to a lot of people. But obviously to the majority of Venezuelans, it doesn't seem ridiculous. It does seem that it's, you know, a long-term aspiration of the government. They've had it in their map for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you know, sure, the Petro administration is well positioned to sort of navigate this, but it doesn't come out as an impartial arbiter because, mm-hmm, of its own domestic priorities. I don't know, Daniel, what do you think?
You know, definitely Colombia should be this kind of broker or mediator with anything that has to do or anything that's related with the Venezuelan political crisis. They, mm-hmm, are the neighboring country. It's important to do so. And we saw that the Petro administration was very interested in being that mediator and actually having that role in order to bring back this democratic transition in Venezuela. And we saw Colombia trying to partner up with the United States to be able to, mm-hmm, to do so. And that's kind of how we got this roadmap to these future Venezuelan presidential elections and whatnot. But what, mm-hmm, what we've been seeing recently is this, these Colombian efforts have kind of been losing momentum, and the United States has kind of gone their own way in approaching Venezuela. And Petro, for some reason, because we saw all of this this energy to actually play this role, has kind of lost sight of being that broker mediator in the Venezuelan political crisis. So what we see is, and here I'm kind of giving you a sneak peek into what we're trying to do for next year. And one of those big political risks that we identify is the Venezuelan political crisis and how Colombia is going to respond to these potential presidential elections during the second semester of 2024 in Venezuela. So we see that as one of those major political risks for the current administration is their stance on the Venezuelan electoral integrity, because we see that this roadmap that had been built to be able to bring back the opposition in Venezuela to participate in politics and this kind of democratic transition in the country, we see that they're actually not really they're not really following through with it. So that's going to be one of those big questions to deal with next year.
That's a really good one. And I hadn't thought of it. I should have thought of it, of course. But I would just imagine that Gustavo Petro will take to Twitter and say something perhaps not so astute and then sort of publicly declare that he believes in the I don't know, the democratic popularity of the Venezuelan people or something like that. Something so blatantly nebulous that he'll only get further in trouble here at home and then be praised by Venezuela, which in itself is receiving a poison chalice internationally. So there's going to be, it's going to be a tough one for that. We've talked about China a lot. We've talked about China, of course, and the investment in the underground, the metro system here. That company is also involved in the highway up through Urabá as well. Is it Czech? Is it called Czech, the company, I think? And you've talked about other investments and so on. But let's go to, you know, as we've got sort of, you know, another 10, 15 minutes here, but let's look at a little bit about, well, this, how has the year gone politically in Colombia when we look at this? I mean, investments, if we're looking at total peace, I have to shift it a little bit because it is the end of the year. And I know that some people will want a bit of a summary of these things. Sergio, how are you feeling at the end of 2023?
Exhausted.
Well, we all are. You're a new dad.
yeah. No, I mean, that's part of it. But also, you know, I think another big part of it is this government creates a lot of news. Yes. So it requires us to always sort of like stay on top of it and always like look at the minutia and, you know, look at the inside baseball that's become increasingly important. I would summarize this year in sort of like three sort of big topics. And the first has to do with the economy, that it settled down after a big ruckus over Petro. His mandate or what he came into government sort of proposing has not been as easy to implement as he would have it. So that has sort of made markets, particularly bonds investors and people in Wall Street, calm down a little bit about the anxiety there was about Gustavo Petro initially. On the second front, I would say, politically speaking, how Petro has squandered his coalition government. He still has some of it, but, you know, he's basically broken up his coalition with all the cabinet shuffles. There's been I'll jump into each of these specifically in a minute. I just want to get my thoughts organized. And then I would also talk about how Petro is losing power after the local elections that happened in October and what that means for the future. Okay. We can talk about security and total peace, and we're not very optimistic about that because that's how the year started, if you remember. Yeah. At 10:45 p.m. on December 31st, 2022, Petro tweeted famously, "We reached a six-month ceasefire with the ELN. And with the Gulf plan and with, you know, these other six cartels," and all these people were like, wow, you know, he actually achieved it. And less than 48 hours later, the ELN was actually not quite right. So I think Petro's peace programs and peace policies have hit a wall, both because of who he's negotiating with, the ELN, the FARC dissidences, etc. These are not necessarily the most politically savvy of organizations, and they also don't bear in mind the best interest for the country. No. And they also don't realize that this is their best chance, perhaps their only chance, of negotiating in good faith with a government that wants to be generous. Mm-hmm. That suggests that in the future governments will not share the same generosity. And they should take advantage of that opportunity. But it seems as though they're taking advantage of that opportunity by trying to extract as many concessions as they can from the government, some of which are completely unpalatable to public opinion. For instance, the ELN insists on maintaining kidnapping as a way to finance their activities. Famously, they kidnapped Luis Diaz's father, Mane Diaz, and that didn't go well with public opinion. But the ELN says, you know, these things are justified. These things are fair game under our ceasefire agreement. And I think, you know, a lot of people call bullshit on that one. Yeah. And so do I.
Yeah.
But what we've seen is that the government's insistence on a total peace and on a ceasefire that is broad and that has tangible benefits for local communities living in rural areas, has translated into a greater territorial control by armed actors and organized armed groups in those territories. So instead of strengthening the state, it seems as though there's an active debilitation of state capacity at the local level, which is in turn strengthening the agency of these organized armed groups, making it even more difficult and peace more elusive in Colombia as a result. Mm. Having said that, and jumping onto the, you know, politics side, President Petro started off the year with a cabinet that many of us were surprised maintained their positions. And that only lasted until mid-February when he sacked Minister Alejandro Gaviria, who had been health minister under Santos and was brought in as education minister under Petro. And after he sacked Gaviria in February, he sacked seven other ministers in early April. And he said the coalition government is no longer sent a big FU to the different political parties. And he said, you know, I'm going to take away your jobs unless you pass my reforms. And instead of, you know, putting in more moderates or people who were known to be technocrats to get things done, he put in loyalists in his cabinet, and that further cemented the idea that Petro is not going to moderate his aspirations to pass legislation in Congress. He's not going to moderate his statements. He's not going to moderate his tweets, because basically, and this was a running joke, the adults in the room left, and he's now left with an applause group, the people who can only applaud what Petro does or says. And that is also, of course, harmful. And then on May 27th, and this is a date that I remember well because it's my child's birthday, the Laura Sarabia scandal erupted. And that day, you know, we had Nannygate, where Laura Sarabia was, allegedly found to have conducted a very strong search of one of her nannies because she allegedly stole money. But then the nanny came on television and said, you know, Laura Sarabia had huge piles of cash and that she traveled frequently to Venezuela on a charter flight to see Armando Benedetti on multiple occasions. And then Armando Benedetti came out and started revealing things about the government, about alleged finance violations in the campaign, etc. So this quickly became a little nightmare for the government that it surprisingly, you know, left off pretty unscathed, because Laura Sarabia is back in government. And although Benedetti's out of government, he's still not revealing very private information about the campaign. And so that at least has been contained for now. And I think that those revelations can become very intricate later on, because they also slashed the president's son, Nicolas Petro, who had allegedly partaken in this web of influencing, of financial influences that he's already admitted to the Fiscalía. So we still need to see how this plays out as the trial proceeds and as more evidence and more witnesses reach agreements with the government, with the Fiscalía, who's also going to change. So that's to pack that in, the political side is a little complicated for the president. In terms of the economy, and as I was mentioning at first, there was all this frenzy about, oh my God, Petro is a far left-wing radical who is going to, you know, expropriate and do all this damage to the economy. And I think a lot of people made decisions based on fear. And there were some who stayed because they were saying, look, you know, Petro doesn't have, like, the government and the executive branch is powerful, but it's not all power. It can't make these broad changes to the functioning of the economy. The central bank is still independent. The courts are still independent. The legislature is still independent. And they're not going to, you know, bend over backwards for the president. And I think when people took that view in mind, they were thinking, well, you know, it's going to be bad, but how much damage can he do? It was a question that I received frequently. And of course, the president did try to do some damage and still tries to do some damage with holding or withholding financing to the healthcare sector, with issuing emergency decrees in La Guajira to try to get more state financing to that department, to try to make his reforms through executive action, to try to push through some of the reforms, including the education reform, the pension reform, and the labor reform, which would be quite negative for the business sector, perhaps not the education reform. But then also, the president has been trying to continue his policy of climate martyrdom. And let me explain that a little bit, what I mean. Colombia emits only 0.5% of CO2 gases. But President Petro has made a decisive choice not to have new exploration or production contracts for oil, gas, and coal, which, by the way, are close to 80% of Colombia's export basket. So while he's doing that, you know, he's also damaging long-term, and this is key, not short-term investment, but long-term investment into these areas, which have continued to be the most important areas for Colombia's overall economy. And this has caused, you know, Ecopetrol stocks to go down. This has also caused the stocks of many of the oil companies that operate in Colombia to go down and have them explore opportunities elsewhere in other countries, like, for instance, Guyana, right? And so the issue here is, yes, Colombia's economy has withstood a big impact. The dollar started at 4,900 the year, and now it closes right under 4,000. So the Petro administration is giving itself, you know, chest bumps about stability. But at the same time, we have a contraction of consumption. We have high inflation. We have a high interest rate from the central bank. And we also have a government that's very willing to engage in deficit growing policies, such as reducing the price of the SOAT, which is the insurance policy for cars and motorcycles, to incentivize people to buy it, but people just don't buy it. He's also tried to raise taxes on or raise prices of fuel, which is a good policy, by the way. But at the same time, this is going to push inflation upwards. And he's also tried to give record increases in the minimum wage, which again, push inflation upwards. So how can he then ask the central bank to reduce interest rates that are meant to control inflation, while at the same time, some of his policies directly incentivize inflation to increase? So that's going to be a big conundrum, you know, as the year closes and as next year begins on the economy. Well, and then finally, yeah. And I'm sorry for taking all this time.
Oh, God.
Finally, there's a local elections bid, yeah, which the government lost handily on October 29th. And we can do a full episode about this, and I think we've already looked into it quite a bit in this podcast before. But clearly, the voters didn't support or didn't endorse the current administration in its outlook. Instead, they went for known quantities, opponents. They also went for people who had previous experience in local administration and traditional parties. And so in that way, this idea that the government had a mandate, as a mandate for broad change, now has an asterisk, because these local mayors and administrators also have a mandate. And the mandate is opposite to the one given to President Petro. So how those two things balance out is going to be a topic that we'll continue to look into as 2024 hits. And all of this analysis that we do is possible because we have people who subscribe to our newsletter. We have people who reach out to us and ask for consultations, because we're able to think about the country's long-term perspectives. So for all you listeners out there, institutional or otherwise, you know, you are more than welcome to help us grow and help us write these fabulous reports that we do.
No small self-promotion there from Sergio, but very well deserved. He had Columbia Risk Analysis actually enjoyed their fifth anniversary this year, a huge deal. I was honored to be invited and be this bum of a journalist, vagabond, was there rubbing shoulders with diplomats and people of industry. But it was quite the event, and congratulations to Columbia Risk Analysis on their five-year anniversary. That was a very, very big summary of what has happened and what will likely happen. And I don't know if we can add very much to that, because, I mean, Daniel, has there been something that Sergio missed? I doubt it, but, you know, feel free.
I think Sergio actually mentioned most of it. I would just add that I do believe that there's still hope for Petro's total peace plans. We're going to see this year is going to be very challenging for the government. We have a new person now steering the wheel on Petro's peace policies that was recently announced, which is Odi Patiño. The government all actually has to come. I mean, they have to think through how they're going to overcome the foot dragging in Congress in order to pass major reforms. So that's going to be another big challenge for the government next year. And also there's kind of like this big question mark and what's going to be the future of these institutional clashes or crisis with the new attorney general, which is also going to be selected I would believe early next year. So that would be kind of like the way we see some efforts from the current government with this so-called national agreement to be able to kind of build up political capital and be able to pass these very ambitious reforms and plans for the country. But as I said at the beginning, I do believe, as it was mentioned by Sergio, it's going to be another very challenging year for the Gustavo Petro administration.
As Sergio said, it's exhausting because this government creates so much news. And I went off and worked. Well, I was working offshore for a month and disconnected myself from the continual slew of the Colombian news cycle. And it was a cathartic break. It really was. I could actually stop being quite so parochial, I think, about Colombian news and just sort of looking at international news a bit more. It's like, oh, it felt good. But, you know, we'll work on this. So we all have to suck it up and understand what's going on. But thank you. Listen, I think this is a great episode. I think we've really covered a lot of ground especially not least your report on China's investments in Colombia and so on. I think that's very important. I think people should definitely read it. You can find it, I guess, on the website. Is it up there? It's Understanding China's Tech Footprint in Colombia, Challenges and Opportunities. It's from December 2023, so hot off the press. Just go to ColumbiaRiskAnalysis.com, right? ColumbiaRiskAnalysis.com. Of course, it's all over Twitter and Facebook and everywhere else as well. You can find Columbia Risk. But yes, get in touch with them. Get in touch because, you know, it's a small team. The email will likely go to the boss. And if you are a student out there, international relations, politics, so on, irrelevant of where you are based, get in touch with them. They're always looking for some people to get involved, hands-on experience, help writing these documents, etc. I've seen a lot of people go through those doors. A lot of people are moving on to, well, obviously they're not moving on to greater things. They're moving across. Let's say they're not moving on to greater things, but that, I mean, it is. But how many people do you have now working for you, Sergio?
So we have a staff of 10, and that doesn't include, the people who come for short stints as volunteers or interns. And again, many of these documents are written with their effort, and they have a direct influence in how these documents are written, where they go. And we, of course, will push this forward for many of them. And so in a way, you know, if you are a graduate student and you don't know what you're doing over the summer, you know, reach out to us. Find us on LinkedIn, find us on Twitter. social media, etc. Let us know that you're interested, and perhaps we can find something to do. The university has a capstone or funding to bring you, and a lot of universities do. Again, we can work something out, but we would love to use your talent to continue building on our stellar reputation so far.
A stellar reputation, indeed. Let me take this moment to say thank you again to Sergio Guzman, the director of Colombia Risk Analysis, Daniel Poveda, the analysis coordinator at Colombia Risk as well. It has been a fascinating and, as always, enlightening chat. There is hope. I mean, Daniel came in with positive aspects there at the end to give us a lift. It's the end of the year. We are all exhausted. It really is. And I don't think next year will be any less exhausting. I think that's the truth of it. I think that's what we'll take from it all. But it has been a great conversation with you all. Left this to say, well, Merry Christmas to those who celebrate, and a Happy New Year to everyone. And thank you, Sergio and Daniel.
Thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah to everybody who's listening.
Thank you, Richard. Happy holidays. Hope to be back on the podcast soon.
You will be. Colombia Risk is on here about 3 or 4 times a year, so you'll be back on before we know it. So, and all of you, the listeners out there, thank you so much for your continued support, your continued listenership throughout this year. We're almost at 500 episodes. The first episode next year will be episode 500. Emily and myself are looking for a star performer to come on as a guest. So please, any ideas, any people that you can think of, any connections that you have, we are all ears. But that is us signing off for 2023. Thank you again. And, well, until 2024. Bye-bye.
The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.